This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Oscar Chacon, co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas, a national network of Latin American immigrant-led and immigrant-serving organizations, talks about Alianza Americas' mission to improve the quality of life of Latin American immigrant communities in the U.S., as well as of peoples throughout the Americas, in the wake of our presidential election, or the takeaway and the way forward from our elections. Oscar Chacon, thank you for joining us. We have been on pins and needles in a state of high anxiety over the whole election season, indeed the entire 4 years since the election of Trump. Talk about what this past 4 years has really meant to our immigrant sisters and brothers, predominantly from South and Central America.
It is basically an exponential increase in the level of concern that people have about their safety. Latino communities have been very much under attack, even from the moment Trump first announced his intention to run for president. Clearly, the past 4 years or so have been extremely difficult, especially because this has been an administration very relentless in advancing an anti-immigrant, and by that I mean largely an anti-Latin American immigrant community war. We can feel it in multiple ways. I mean, and it is not just an attack against people without visas in the U.S., but it is an attack against immigrant communities in general, from denying people the right to apply for asylum to making extremely difficult for people to pursue U.S. citizenship via naturalization. It's been just an exponential increase in the level of pressures, in the level of siege mentality that we have been enduring of this administration. Clearly, you know, that line of attack was not something begun by the Trump administration. Sadly, it's something that the country has been at for more than 30 years. But clearly, this administration has taken it to a level unseen before, especially in the field of rhetoric that is so poisonous against the immigrant community.
The rhetoric, the attitudinal component of white supremacy, which has been stroked and stoked by the Trump administration, the ugliness, the white supremacist, white nationalist sentiment is not going to be easily put back into, I can only say, the realms of hell. I mean, the militia, the most aggressive right revolutionist forces and most ardent nationalist and supremacist forces have been summoned. How are we to understand that in terms of continuing to aspire to equal rights and justice for our immigrant sisters and brothers in the climate that is still to come?
My reading on how white supremacy, racism driven by white supremacy, has grown so strongly, and you know, I think that the fact that the election, in which the official day was Tuesday, the 3rd of November, show us there are a lot of people who still to this date, in spite of everything that we have seen over the past 4 years or so, still believe in Donald Trump and still want to give their vote to Donald Trump. But I think it's important to share with you the fact that within the leadership of Alianza America, which is an immigrant-led organization in the U.S., we still believe that most people, even those who have voted for Trump, are not necessarily people that I would regard as irreparable white supremacists. I believe that there is something that we need to pay attention to. The level of impact that economic inequality, the way wealth and income has been steadily been flushed from what used to be the middle class, including, of course, white folks, but also Latinos, Blacks, you know, Asians, and many other ethnic minorities, into a very small group of people who are basically, for all practical purposes, an oligarchy in the U.S. And the fact that we have, and I don't mean we, Alianza Americas, I mean we as a country, and I actually hold accountable both political parties for this, no solutions have really been provided to this reality that engenders a sense of despair, a sense of economic anxiety, insecurity, in face of no solutions that are rational, no solutions that build upon the best inclinations, the best nature of people, but instead, you know, comes about a white nationalist like Donald Trump, people are driven and pulled into that particular direction. And I think that that's going to be a huge task that we all will need to find a way to tackle, irrespective to who in the end becomes the president that will be in the White House for the next 4 years.
I just want to press the issue of the climate in this country, which has been given license, certainly in the last 4 years, but it is part of white supremacy, has been part of the DNA since the original sin of slavery and theft of the land from the indigenous population. At this juncture, it certainly has been given license, but otherwise it has been perhaps stamped down, or by and large ignored. We certainly have been pressed as a populace to be a colorblind society which fails to acknowledge the prevalence of whole systems of control and institutionalized white supremacy and racism, etc. So given the fact that we also are dealing with a population, the Latinx population, which has even been subject to the xenophobia, has extended to conceptualization by the Trump administration and beyond of virtually eugenics as a way of it seeping into the general populace. What should be an agenda and deal with this, even more so in the context of a president who would insist that in any curriculum that seeks to emphasize the history and the reality of oppression and disparity of treatment and discrimination be rooted out in our school system? What, as a society, we need to do to address the enormity of racism, white supremacy, xenophobia, as it has historically existed?
Yes. I think that you are absolutely correct, and I believe that the challenge is even more complex because in many ways we have been guided over the years in a line of thought that suggests that we can tackle each dimension of oppression from an isolated perspective. You can definitely see how from a women's rights perspective, that struggle happens very often without looking at the underlying class, racial oppressions that are historic, that are part, as you said, I mean, of the DNA of the nation. And I believe that going forward, again, irrespective to who end up in the White House for the next 4 years, given the very unfair system that we have to actually select a president. You know, most people don't even realize that we do not actually elect a president per se. You know, we actually elect electors, and that is also part of the, what I call essentially the increasingly broken democratic system that we are asked to be part of, when in reality that is also an expression that it's very much linked to this system of oppression that, again, takes the shape of multiple layers. And I think that going forward, we need to find a way of articulating not just an agenda about what we are against, but an agenda about what we want to bring forward. What is the end goal of what we are trying to transform? And in doing so, it's going to be crucial that we find a way of combining multiple issues, combining multiple layers of oppression. If we only let ourselves limit to one or another particular expression of this rather oppressive system, we are going to continue to be very easily pit one against the other. The question of economic inequality needs to be next to the fight against white supremacy and racism, the fight against xenophobia in the U.S., the fight against homophobia and other forms of discrimination based on sexual orientation, on gender, the environment, you know, all these are pieces of a system that we need to find a better way, not only of relating to fighting against, but at the same time, be able to propose what is the end goal that we hope to achieve. Because if we only limit our struggles to what we are up against, that's not good enough. We need to be able to offer people a powerful, inspirational definition of what is it that we are actually for.
I wonder if you might be able to educate us on what you think happened with the Latinx vote. It's not a homogeneous community. How are we to understand that vote and the communities that did vote from the Latinx population?
The very fabrication of a label called Latinos or even Latinx, it's actually an attempt to way oversimplify what in reality is a collection of communities that are really bound together by more than anything else, you know, a regional affinity. They are all people who have Latin American origin. But in reality, we are indeed an extremely diverse universe. If we take all of the Hispanic, Latino, Latinx community in the U.S., we're talking about nearly 65 million people. If you want to only speak about borders, that's about 32 million people. The reality is we are extremely different. You take a country in Latin America with about 32 million population, you will find every single expression about everything within that country. That is the best way of thinking about the so-called Latinx community in the U.S., because we are very diverse. Sadly, we are yet, you know, to find better strategies that can ensure that this particular segment of the population in the U.S. is properly represented and is properly sitting, you know, in the tables where decisions are being made about us. In that respect, I mean, I will not be surprised if once we have data available, we come to find that Donald Trump managed to retain the level of support that he was able to secure in 2016, which, depending who you ask, it could be either 20% or up to 30% of the people who voted in that election in 2016 that are of Latin American origin. The most people of Latin American origin, again emphasizing that we are a diverse bunch, that we in the end care about a better future for our children, that we care about having access to the best education possible, that we care about health care because we've been dying disproportionately under the pandemic moment we are still through. And all those issues are actually very much in common, you know, with the interest of most other Americans. Now, we also care deeply about having an immigration policy that acknowledges us as people, as human beings, therefore treat us as such. Because the policy that is now in place, which, by the way, was adopted in 1996, was actually a law that has caused so much damage, you know, particularly to Latin American immigrant communities. So I would expect that no matter, again, what the outcome of this presidential election ultimately is, that we keep also making our way be felt in every area of political engagement that we can, including, of course, being more demanding of the people who represent us. Because we pay tax, we should indeed demand every ounce of attention, every ounce of support that we deserve.
The policies of the U.S., which have been prevalent the last 4 years and before this, what do you say to and how should you understand and how should we fight to look at the international policies of the U.S. government? How have those policies fed the stream of immigrants that have come here from Latin America, certainly from Mexico as well? What are we to say and understand about those, and how are we to evaluate the problematic there?
Even most of the so-called immigrant rights activists in the U.S. are fairly unfamiliar, to put it nicely, you know, about. Most U.S. immigrant rights and immigration policy advocates really tend to believe that our challenges begin when people arrive into the U.S., when in reality, the movement of people, which very often happens to be a forced movement, is actually related to the very economic, political ways in which the U.S. relates to Mexico, Central American countries, Caribbean nations, and the rest of Latin America, but the same is true for the rest of the world. And the bottom line is, you know, the phrase that at times has become so much the source of controversy, chickens are coming home to roost, that is very much applicable to the situation of the way people who are one way or another pushed out from their countries needs to be understood. The policies the U.S. has pursued in Latin America in particular, whether it is the imposition of the very broken economic policies that have led us to so much economic inequality in the U.S., we've been doing the same for the last 50 years in Latin America, you know, imposing policies that make everything only become centered on how can stockholders and how can rich people accumulate more wealth at the expense of course, I mean, impoverishing even more the vast majorities of Latin America. But on top of that, we have also been actively supportive of regimes that actually push people out because of political persecution. There is hardly any responsibility on the part of the U.S. when it comes to facing the consequences of policies that are, again, U.S. imposed. You know, even the question of youth gangs in Central American countries, you know, the so-called MS-13 or MS-18, you know, that people have grown to despise because of the way these issues are portrayed in mass media, people don't realize that gangs were non-existent in Central America through the end of the 1980s, and that the only reason why we now have a gangs problem is because the U.S. deported very irresponsibly people who had become involved in violent gangs in the U.S., which in itself is also an expression of these structural conditions of oppression, and then send them back to countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And of course, and over time, this has become indeed a problem. And this is without even talking about the so-called war on drugs, you know, which ironically, in spite of all the money that has been spent, and I'm talking about more than $1 trillion over the past 40 years, there continues to be plenty of drugs coming into the country. And you cannot really say that that is because of a broken immigration policy or because we don't have border walls. I mean, there are other connections that, again, bring us back to the central question of the level of responsibility that the U.S. government has actually had in explaining why there is such a flow of people particularly coming to the U.S.
The agenda for Alianzas Americas in the period to come, and what is it that progressive people should be endorsing?
As people of Latin American origin, as immigrants in the U.S., how can we drive, you know, a political advocacy agenda that actually makes sense for our communities, but at the same time makes sense for societies in countries of origin from where we come from, and how can they also make sense to the public in general, you know, in the U.S.? We have basically identified, there are basically four key goals that we have identified as critical for us to advance. One is to really look much more deeply and critically about the multiple layers of oppression that exist in our country, in our world, identify how economic inequality relates to a structural, historical racism and white supremacy, how those two relate, you know, to gender oppression, to the discrimination against people because of their sexual orientation. So all these issues for us boil down to fighting head-on the multiple layers of inequality and oppression. Two, we need to also be able to identify innovative ways in which we can contribute to renewing the value of democracy. Democracy, as we have known it in the U.S., is deeply broken, and it needs to be changed if we are to have any hope that young people will actually want to be engaged of transforming the societies we are a part of. Number three, we believe it is absolutely crucial to fight head-on against the dominant narrative that tends to paint communities that are minority communities, be that, you know, by race, be that by ethnicity, be that by sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera, and actually celebrate what we really are and educate people about the fact that we are beautiful, creative, smart, committed, dedicated people, and put that message forward every time we can. And finally, we also believe that it is crucial to fight for the recognition that the people behind what we call migration is actually that. They are human beings, they are people, and they ought to be treated with respect, with dignity, and following laws that truly put at the center the importance of respecting human rights.
What do we do to really utilize and enhance the electoral process? Is it about creating an independent party of workers and historically oppressed groupings, about building better election mechanisms and access on the local basis? How do you see utilizing the electoral structure to make it a much more robust and representative tool?
I do believe that we need to indeed do a better job getting ourselves organized in multiple ways and in multiple spaces, including the notion of a political party that truly recognizes the value of communities like ours, a political party that puts at the heart of it the economic agenda of communities that have forever been left out, oppressed, ignore and beat them up. It's not an easy task, but we see it related to the larger question of how do we imagine a way of getting people becoming more engaged with activities, not just electorally, but on a more day-to-day basis, that are important for people to become more invested in change processes that deliver tangible results that improve the way of life people are actually living.
So is the task ahead primarily one of organization building, not merely reactive protests, which of course are important and very often stimulated by social media, which lacks a certain, is fundamentally a soundbite. And I say this by way of saying you must support venues like a WBAI radio, which are truly the voice and the megaphone for people's movements. But having said that, is the central task to build organizations that have sustaining power to structure democratic projects to empower we the people?
Absolutely. That is indeed very much what we have in mind. We believe that it is absolutely crucial to understand that we need to aspire for more, that everything begins, you know, by actually laying out as clearly, as boldly, and as inspirationally as we can a definition of what is it that we want. We need to also clarify what values, you know, do we want to really embrace. We need to also define very clearly structures, you know, that people can become a part of, because only groups in history that were able to achieve a high level of organized participation in the pursuit of a given political agenda, you know, with of defined objectives, are the examples that we can relate to that clearly have achieved more than others. And we believe it is crucial to answer positively to the question of, do we want to be in a position of exercising power? I think that the answer is absolutely yes. We just sponsored a webinar about a week ago or so where we actually explore the relationship between protest and actual transformational change. But among the things that we came up is that we need to be very deliberate about what do we want to do. And wanting to exercise power is one question that we need to answer absolutely, positively, with a yes. Because unless we do so, you know, we may run the risk of being very busy, very active, very engaged in protest, and in the end, be tired and burn out. And that's not something we want.
How do people keep track of and support Alianzas Americas?
We have a webpage that allows people to become connected with us by becoming part of our mailing list. I invite anybody who may be listening to visit us at alianzaamericas.org. And Alianza, let's spell it because it may be unfamiliar, is A-L-I-A-N-Z-A, and then the word Americas, altogether.org. Also follow us through social media. We are very active in Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our YouTube channel can be easily searched, Alianza Americas. And you can also become familiar with all the content that we are periodically putting out. And I always say the most direct, straightforward way in which people can also be supportive of a social enterprise, political enterprise like us, is by donating your financial support, which you can also do through our webpage or through other social media platforms that we manage.
Oscar Chacon, I really want to thank you for spending the time with us, and most strategically for the work that you have been doing these many years and for the organizing, educating, agitating that shows us that we can empower the people to make another world possible and that we are the ones to do so. It's been a pleasure.
Indeed. Well said, Mimi.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.